Ever catch yourself eating the same flavorless dinner 3 days in a row? Dreaming of something better? Well, HelloFresh is your guilt-free dream come true, baby. It's me, Keke Palmer. Let's wake up those taste buds with hot, juicy pecan-crusted chicken or garlic butter shrimp scampi. Mm. Hello Fresh. Stop dreaming of all the delicious possibilities and dig in at HelloFresh.com. Let's get this dinner party started.
Welcome to the Cosmic Moments podcast. I'm your host, Chanel Denton, and together we're going to enjoy conversations and content around mastering transitions, manifesting abundance, and managing changes and shifts during times of growth. Join me as we learn from teachers, philosophers, entrepreneurs, both past and present. Welcome to Cosmic Moments.
Today I'm with Burr, the founder of Calmly Events, a space for mindful fun where baby animals assist us in the practice of meditation. Burr is a qualified meditation and breathwork facilitator, as well as a successful entrepreneur, or what I like to call a yogapreneur, taking her passions of creating a compassionate world and turning it into a thriving and growing business. Thank you for not only being here to join me in these conversations, but also for what you're creating. I've been fortunate enough to be at some of the events you've invited me to teach, which has just been so lovely. Mm. But to see the profound effect that you've created in these people and actually being a part of that has just, yeah, been so beautiful, and why I think our friendship has grown.
Thank you for opening a space for me to be here, and also to create an impact on the world that we're obviously both aligned on. Like, this is a journey that both of us have come upon, because it's really important.
Tell me a little bit about how you got on this path.
When you say this path, are you talking about the spiritual journey, or are you talking about Calmly as the business?
Okay, yeah, well, I want to talk about everything. So let's start with your meditation path, where it started, where you woke up and said, I want to be a meditation teacher. Or did that even happen? Or was it just like, I want to learn how to meditate? And then it kind of...
Oh, it was crazy. It was so crazy. There were two big moments. The first one, when I knew that I had to go to meditation. The second one, when I knew that I had to teach. Both of them were like this incredible, irresistible feeling that I could not run from. And it was like I wanted to run from it. And I still kind of do sometimes. It's like I'm afraid that I'm not going to be able to do it, or I'm not going to do it well, which is actually inevitably going to happen. But that's part of the path and the journey, right? To just accept that you're not going to do it perfectly, but it's still worth doing. I had no choice. It was like, you do this or you die. And not like die as in a physical sense, but just die inside and just accept that you're not going to live your life. You're going to be vulnerable. You're not going to enjoy it. So it's like, you're going to do it. So the first time it happened was when I was in a relationship with a really, really lovely man who took really good care of me and provided for everything. But we couldn't connect on the same level. We were very different. And I felt I had been so inauthentic for so long. It all started, this inauthenticity, when I was 12 years old. Well, actually, it would have started before then, between 8 and 12, because that's when the sexual abuse first started from my stepdad. Mm. It didn't really cross the line until I was 12. But after that was really hard, because that was around the same time that Mum left to go to New York. I've re-experienced this moment through meditation and breathwork, actually.
And no one around then knew about the abuse that was going on, or did they?
No. They didn't know.
Okay. Yeah. And did you not feel any kind of relief that you were escaping the tormentor in any way?
Yes, there was definitely relief. Maybe that was why I didn't feel like I had to say anything back then. Because I knew so my stepmom came over from Australia to look after us. And during that time, I was like, you have 6 months and then he's not going to be able to get you. Mm. So you can, it's fine. Just deal with it. Yeah. And I knew, you know, Mum was in such a tumultuous headspace, and I didn't want to upset my brother and sister or my dad especially. So I just kept it in.
Yeah.
And then, and then from there, it was like another maybe 4 years before I felt like I could speak about it. And I told my brother and sister, and they freaked out. But we all kind of still, again, just didn't deal with it because we're all kids, you know. Like, my sister was 2 years older than me, my brother's 3 years older than me.
And she wasn't being a victim of the abuse, your older sister?
She said that she always felt weird, but he never crossed the line with her. So during that whole time, like from 12 years old to like 20 something, I was suppressed. And I think it was, like you were saying, that lack of control, right, because mum left because she wasn't happy. So I thought maybe, reflecting on it now, I think maybe I went around just every single person that I knew trying to make them happy, to make up for this failure that had left me in such a horrible place. But I didn't even realise that's what I was doing because I was just a kid.
Yeah, wow.
And during that time, like, I developed a few eating disorders. I had, like, just crazy levels of social anxiety that were escalating. I was just so out of control. Like, that was, I knew it was getting worse and worse. Couldn't stop analysing people whenever they were with me, like their eye contact, the body positioning, body language, tone of voice, the flow in the conversation. I'd have things I was going to talk about already before. It was crazy. It was exhausting. And I actually read about it later on. I think that hypersensitivity comes from those situations of abuse because you're so used to seeing a certain rhythm in your caregiver. You know, like they blink their eyes this certain way, or their facial muscles twitch, or they're rattling on the table or something. And that, you know, those are their tells. So you become really sensitive to their tells, so that you, as a protection mechanism, and then that's kind of like maladaptive when you're an adult.
As painful as that journey must have been, and how hard it is for us to hear it, you know, and the anger and the emotions that come up, you were a child, you were abused, but it's almost amazing that you have not just suppressed it now, but you've taken that time to work on the journey to understand it in a positive way in your life, which is pretty profound. Have you had contact with your stepdad since then?
Oh, actually, when I first told my brother and sister, they sent him a really aggressive email. Like, I didn't know until I was like 23, but apparently he replied like all those years ago and said, "I'm so sorry." And then I never heard from him again.
And you don't know where he is now, and you don't. Do you have an interest to kind of confront him, or how does that feeling go?
I would love to. I would love to talk to him and give him that forgiveness, I think, because I think for someone to do that to somebody that you love, there has to be something that happened to you. You know, that's like learned behavior. And have him say, I'm sorry, it wasn't your fault. And I suppose we are forever healing. It's always a journey.
Well, I mean, I think it's pretty profound, you know, you having the courage to actually share this.
Yeah, I've never gone on record before, so this is pretty intense.
The fact that you're able to get to a space now where you're forgiving him is pretty profound in the healing as well.
Yeah.
You know, because that inner release of forgiveness is something that can just project you into so many amazing places. And
yeah, well, I think I'm just realizing that there's no other way. It's the same thing. It's like you tried everything, you did all the things, you did the psychology, you tried hypnotherapy, all your external things, meditation, yoga, exercise, nutrition. So you have no choice. Like, the only thing you can do if you really want to be free of your unhappiness is to love. Literally, that's it. I was going to finish that sentence and I realized that was it. It's just to love.
Then how did that play out in your relationship?
Oh, I was so bad. That's what we were getting. Yeah. Okay. So I had a lot of fear around intimacy. And again, this was another thing that I learned from studying psychology, actually. All right. So there's these things called schemas in childhood that you create, and it's kind of like the structure or the filter or like the way that you see a concept, and then you understand that concept the rest of your life. And so my understanding is that as a child, I created a schema for love, which would have been on the top half, like, you know, affection, joy, you know, giving, play, education, compliments. And then down the bottom, it's also like shame and fear and anxiety and like dread, you know, horror, all these things. And so that kind of got all looped into one concept of love.
Yeah.
And so I think I took that concept into my relationships.
And so would that be how you express love as well?
Actually, weirdly enough, how I express love is how I expressed love was to try and make that person happy as much as possible all the time, which is impossible. And so naturally it would injure my self-concept whenever he was unhappy, because then I take it personally. I'm like, oh, you know, failure, shame, you're not doing it. On top of that, fear that he's going to abandon you just like mum did because you couldn't make her happy either. And so I feel as though, you know, there were flaws in both of us, but I feel like it was very difficult. I feel like I was a difficult person to be in a relationship with. It was so hard for me to just be real, just be authentic, be in the moment.
Okay. So you've got to a point in your life now where you've confronted your childhood abuse. You're in a relationship with a loving man, but you're not happy.
No.
So you turn to meditation. Or is that what happened?
Pretty much. I was so unhappy. I was like crying all the time. I knew up until that point that I had a lot to work on in terms of my self-development and processing emotion. It's pretty self-aware considering I was that disconnected. But at that moment, that was when I was like, okay, you probably have to do something pretty drastic now. You can't just let this get worse.
Yeah.
And then, and then that's when my friend Jade came back from Vipassana. Yeah. For anyone who doesn't know what that is, Vipassana is like a 10-day meditation. It's called a retreat, but it's actually a boot camp.
Yeah.
10 days where you just meditate for 10 hours in complete silence, no technology, no eating after midday, no exercise, no reading, nothing. It's just meditation. And she came back from that and she was so different. She was so spun out. I don't think she remembers, but she came and met me at Grilled and her hair was just like a bird's nest. And like, I think she was wearing like some sort of like Hessian bag dress. Like she just looked like such a hippie. And I never identified her as that before. She's like, "Bo, you've got to go." And I was like, you know, processing the last few years of my life. And I was like, yep, I do have to go. I was like dead set on it. I was like, this is great. She's transformed her life. I need a transformation. I'm going to go.
Hang on. Okay. So for someone that doesn't understand what Vipassana is and you're saying that she's transformed her life, all I'm hearing is she came to you with a potato sack and her hair in a mess. How did you see this transformation that you felt, oh, I want a piece of that?
Right. So she said the verbatim, the words were, "I now know things that I can't unknow." She's like, it will give you a tool. It's just a tool. And it's a tool that you'll be able to use across everything in your life. That sounded pretty good. I thought the hardest thing would be probably being away from food and comforts. It's not. So not.
Yeah, because it's total silence. You can't talk. You can't...
And the talking things.
Right. You can't do anything, can you?
All of that stuff is easy, man.
Oh, really?
Oh, yeah. The hard stuff is like sitting there with your chaos, your crazy mind. It just tries in every single possible way to pull you out of peace. Like, it will do everything. It's like, makes you hungry when you're not hungry, makes you thirsty, makes you cold, makes you hot, makes you a victim, like pulls up pain from the past, pulls up pain in your body, manifests just random pain. Like, sometimes it felt like there was like a, sometimes I was sure there must be something wrong, but it would just be my mind creating this like incredible like temple stabbing on like the left side or something, and then I'd just be with it and it would pass. So yeah, it's what the mind does to you, and you just sit there for like 10 hours and observe it. You just observe it, non-reaction, observe. It's like, oh, feels like
sounds like hell.
it kind of was. But it was amazing.
Okay, so you did this 10 days of complete silence, learning. It's hours of meditation, right? Just sitting there. What kind of meditation was it? Was it transcendental? What's the lineage of that meditation?
Oh, it's Buddhist. It's insight meditation.
Can you give us a little explanation to what that means?
Yeah. So it's called Anapana, and it's basically breath awareness. So it's just witnessing the natural breath as it moves over your upper lip, below the nostrils, above the upper lip. And that's it. So there's no mantras. You don't use any objects of attention or focus, just your sensations. And the whole thing behind that is that if you can feel into your sensations, then you can make your mind sensitive. Oh, this is going way, way back.
Mm-hmm.
And I might get a few of these details wrong.
Okay. Just to explain it as well as you can, I guess.
Yeah. Okay, so there's the sensation in the body, there's the perception that we lay over the top, and there's the reaction. There's one step that I've missed. But in this, so Goenka talks about how you have craving and aversion. So things that you crave, you know, sensations of pleasure, things that you run from, or aversion, things that don't feel pleasant. And then we spend our whole lives either chasing something or running away from something, and so we're never actually here. And then what we do in Vipassana is we sit with the physiological sensations in the body to to begin with just the sensations below the nostrils and above the upper lip, and we make our minds really sensitive. So then when we go through the body, we can feel the pleasure, feel the pain, and stay in a place of non-attachment.
Okay.
So then to generalize that to everyday life, so in everyday life you have these kind of knee-jerk reactions to your emotions.
Mm-hmm.
Right? Like, this doesn't feel good, so I'm not going to do it.
Right.
So maybe you've got to make that cold call. Maybe you have to make an awkward conversation with someone and you have this knee-jerk reaction. I don't want to do that, so I'm just not going to do it and sabotage myself because now I don't have any sales, or now I feel really tense and uneasy with this person because I didn't have the conversation. And so in Vipassana, what we learn to do is we witness the core of the sensation. We don't try and change the behavior on the external level because that's very contextual. Don't try and change the thought or the perception of it. Instead, you go all the way back so that you're so, so sensitive to your initial physiological response, which is pain. And you stay unattached and unreactive.
Okay.
Mm-hmm. You observe it and let it pass, and then you can do what you want to. Well, then you can perceive what you want to perceive and actually create what you want in your life.
So before going to Vipassana, did you have a regular meditation practice, or had you not meditated at all?
I'd only done like 15 minutes, like maybe 15 minute sets, based off this book called The Power of Your Subconscious Mind.
Wow.
Yeah. It was intense. And I definitely did it. If meditation can be done wrong, which it can't be, but like what I understand of meditation now relative to then is like I definitely put myself through way more suffering than was necessary.
Wow.
Yeah.
Okay, so you do the Vipassana, and then what? You come back to normal life and you're like,
oh right, no, okay, so at this point I didn't even know that there was things, words like consciousness, I didn't even know, I'd never heard that word before. Anyway, so it was really funny. On the eighth day, I was sitting behind this girl and she was having a 5-minute conversation. You're allowed a 5-minute conversation with the teacher after each day. And she was asking the teacher, I was crying during my meditation and I was like, felt like I was going to throw up and you know, I didn't understand what I was feeling. Right, she's just saying this to the teacher. And I was listening behind her with my eyes closed. And I was thinking to myself, like, it was so bad. But this is just to demonstrate how much I've changed since then.
Yeah.
I was sitting there and I was like, what in fluffy? I was like, that is never going to happen to me. I was like, nothing is happening. Like, it felt like my back was getting really strong and my mind was just getting crazier. But I was like, well, you know, I'm sure this has its own practical benefit in some way. I'm like, at least my back is strong. It's really good. So I went back to my room and I was like sitting in my room and I was just like going about things. And then I started to form this thought of like, I wonder if that will happen to me. But it didn't get there. It was like, I wonder if that will. And then like out of the like periphery of my sensory experience, I can't really explain it because it's not like it was visual, it's just a sensation, I began to feel as though my memories were crowding into my space. And I had this knowing of like, oh this is all the stuff that you don't want to look at, this is all that shit that you've been avoiding your whole life, and then I started to laugh because I was like really excited because I knew that I had been sabotaging all my relationships and sabotaging my entire life because I couldn't look and accept what had happened. And so I did. And I just like surrendered to it. And then I was like crying and howling as I like dropped into my childhood self. It wasn't like I was remembering. I just became her.
Wow.
And I was like reliving the experiences as if I was like looking into the mirror and he's like behind me with his hand on my shoulder saying things like, I'm going to make you feel good. This kind of shit. It was so intense. I re-experienced being in the bed and like all these things. And it was crazy because I was like crying, but then I was like laughing a lot.
Yeah.
Like laughing so much.
I mean, that sounds like for people that are suppressing stuff, that sounds incredibly scary and confronting. Like, to relive tortures, like, oh my God.
Yeah. But it was freeing. It was so freeing.
Okay.
Like, this is, this is why they screen Vipassana residents, participants as well, because obviously if you've got a lot of stuff that you haven't dealt with, you basically are creating a space where it can appear and you don't have a lot of support. I could have gone to management and been like, help me. But, you know, if you've got like schizophrenia or psychosis, it can be very risky to not have that immediate someone there just guiding you through those experiences. But yeah, but no, for me, it was very wonderful. It's like healing, profound. And then, I left and I was in such a good mood.
So you did the whole 10 days.
The whole 10 days.
And you came back and you were blissed out.
Then I decided to go into therapy because I was like, well, clearly you have issues. So I went to really work hard with my psychologist and really knuckled down on my personal growth. Because your mind will only perceive what it thinks is possible. And so if you feel offended or hurt or angry, then it's because you're angry at yourself over something. They've shown that to you, or you're hurt because there's a wound in your childhood somewhere or in your psyche that you haven't allowed yourself to heal or forgive yourself for. Anyway, so moving on. So I went, I went really, really hard. And this is, again, the wrong way to go about it. Or was it the right way? I began to schedule everything. So I'd get up at 5:30. I'd go straight to the gym. I would eat a really healthy, balanced breakfast. I would go to work. I would finish and then listen to a podcast of inspiring podcast. I'd then eat dinner for like 45 minutes, do some meditation, read a self-help book, go to bed. I just did that every single day for like, I can't even remember how long. I cut out everything that was bad in my diet. Could only consume positive content. It was crazy. It was amazing. And it was also quite painful.
Yeah.
It wasn't until I was listening to this talk by Warren Buffett. So funny. Yeah. And I got this like message from the universe. This is that feeling I was talking about again. There's this feeling of like, it sounds so stupid, but the message was really strongly, you have to give up sugar. Yeah. That was my cosmic moment. It was so crazy because I was literally just watching this talk by Warren Buffett and I was doing the exercise that he gave me thinking, I'm like, you know, I do all these exercises all the time. It was like talking about like, you know, what traits do you want as a person? What traits do you not want? Okay, what actions and habits can you change in your life to get what you want and to repel what you don't want? And then this just out of nowhere, this feeling comes up. I did the same thing. I was like, no. Because I'm still, by this point, I was still not identifying as like a, for lack of a better definition, I'm just going to use the word hippie. I still didn't identify that way. So I was like, what? And then I was like, okay. So I just did it. I just gave up sugar. And it was fascinating because after that, it just set off this like, everything was so rapid after that. Every time I started to suppress emotion, there was nothing. I couldn't suppress it anymore because I couldn't like get my hit of dopamine, my sugar, or I just had to feel however I was feeling. So where I used to go for like 3 weeks or so of just repressing my like negative emotions like fear, sadness, anger, instead they were just able to come up because I couldn't take something immediately to make me feel good. And so I just processed. And then it became like, well, nothing's making you feel good anymore. So you should probably do good.
Wow.
Yeah, because that actually feels good. Like, what makes you happy? So then that's when I sat down at a big goal sheet and, like, plotted everything out. And I was like, oh, of course. You have to do what you did, what happened to you. You have to do that for everyone.
What you've created now is just so beautiful and amazing. And to be so vulnerable gives people the permission to not have to think that they have to be perfect to do the practice.
Oh my God.
And how healing the practice can be.
Yeah.
You know, if you've come from turmoil and you've actually done all the self-work to be at a place where you're at now and you are sharing this beautiful practice that is helping people, I've seen it. It's, yeah, thank you.
Thank you. That's so lovely of you to say.
When we're in the process of healing, right?
Yeah.
It's easy to say, this has happened to me and I'm growing from it, but poor me at the same time, I guess.
Yes.
You know, putting poor me can actually become quite debilitating.
Yes, absolutely.
So how do we stop ourselves from going into that victim space?
Okay. I'm going to look at this from a practical setting. So in my meditations, when I experience the traumas or the negative emotions, you allow yourself to feel the sensations in the body and allow those emotions and experiences to be let go of. If you notice that you're engaging your conscious mind and it's starting to create all kinds of stories, extra narratives that are just not part of what actually happened, then you can't feel those experiences. They're just like a story that you've created, extra words, extra like, I should have done this, like, I wish I'd done that, why did this happen, this is all my fault, rah, rah, rah. Then you let go of those by coming back into the body. Yeah.
So is it a matter of practically recognizing negative self-talk? Is that what it is?
It's something that comes with time, with practice. In the beginning, you just feel, and you feel, and at a certain point, you'll also feel that it doesn't hurt anymore.
Mm.
It's like instead of contracting, you'll just begin to expand and open. And when you feel like it doesn't hurt anymore, the ego can sometimes come in and try and create more pain. Like, well, remember this. This is what you did to that person. And then you're like, and you just go back into it. But what it is noticing when that goes like this and your whole body is different. You can feel it in the body. And that's when it's like completion of that healing is taking place. You can move forward now. You know, there is no wrong way to meditate, but I did create all kinds of unnecessary suffering for myself. When I went to Vipassana, I had this whole mindset, like, I had to do it. And if I didn't do it, then I was a piece of shit. Mm. Like, it was like, I pushed myself and drove myself into the ground. I was always the first one in the room at, like, 4:30 in the morning. There were, like, not many people there because it was an optional sitting at 4:30, but I would always be there, and then I would always be, like, the last to leave. I would, like, wait until I could hear nearly everyone was out of the room, and then I would leave.
Why?
Because I wanted to be the best. I wanted to be, like, the best at meditation, like, the best good person. Like, it was the funniest and, like, most, like, counterintuitive thing that I had ever done. It's just, like, I just wanted to be so good at meditation that I wouldn't have to feel like scared or out of control or in pain anymore, which is counterintuitive to the whole practice. The whole practice is like let go and surrender and stay unattached to whatever story you've created about
yourself. Like, are you a competitive person?
I'm highly competitive. I used to avoid air hockey because I was afraid that I would get too competitive. I was like, and still am, highly competitive. Yeah, even if it's just with me, it's just, like, crazy. So competitiveness in and of itself is not inherently good or bad. It is just the intention you put behind it. You can use it to drive yourself into a pit of shame, or you can use it to drive good.
Yeah, that's a good concept. I like that one.
Mm.
Okay, so you did Vipassana, you did the 10 days, you came back.
And then I took off LA to San Francisco, Manhattan, India, and California. Yeah. To learn everything, because I realized that I wanted to share it with people, or at least tell people where to go, but there was nowhere in Brisbane. So that's why I initially went to LA, because I wanted to see Unplug. So Unplug is like a meditation studio over there, which is they're doing what I do at scale. Like, they've got like two studios now, and I wanted to see how they did it, how they made it so that everyone wanted to come, and it was like super popular and it wasn't intimidating. There was no like weird feeling or fear.
Yeah.
Yeah. And it's like that. I met the founder. Her name's Susie. And so they've got like 9 meditation classes a day that are like all kind different kinds, like mantra, crystal healings, Reiki, sound bath, meditation with, oh my God, you've got to go check it out when you go to the States.
Yeah.
Yeah. I'll tell you all the studios and you just go.
Yeah, we'll put them in the show notes as well, so other people can go, yeah.
Yeah.
Wow. Okay.
So, yeah. So then I went and I sat like 600 classes, I think.
Wow.
Yeah. Across all the studios and then came back from that. And I had all this data after that. I was like, great, now I know how to do it. But then something happened. I started teaching breath work, and I got scared because the effects that I was eliciting in people I didn't understand.
So you had experienced breath work over in LA?
Oh, yeah.
Okay, and then you came and said, I'm going to teach people, and people started having these physical reactions that you
didn't
and emotional.
Understand.
Okay.
Mm.
Okay.
So then I got scared. So then I was like, you don't know what you're doing. You need to go back. So I went to Ojai, did a teacher training, went to one of Stan Grof's workshops for spiritual emergency, which is like the Western term would be psychosis.
Mm.
And then went and did another course in India, did some Reiki and sound therapy courses over there as well, and then came back. And then I was like, okay, I realize now nobody has the answers.
Wow.
Yeah, I went over there and I was like, someone will know what to do in every situation. Like, they will be able to tell me if somebody is having a psychotic break, this is what you do. Or if, you know, this person comes to you and they've got this problem, this is how you help them. Nobody fucking knew. I would go, I interviewed every single teacher, I take notes. Someone asked me if I was a journalist once at a meditation school. They were like, you ask a really good question. I was just like, I just need to know so that I can give this to people.
Yeah.
And and now I just came to the conclusion. I'm like, nobody knows. Everyone literally is just doing what they think is the best thing that they can do, and they're going off their own experience. And it was like this huge epiphany for me, because I was like, oh, that's what you have to do. You have to trust.
Mm.
You've experienced this. You give that to people, they will have whatever experience they're going to have. But what you're doing for them is not giving them your wealth of knowledge or whatever. You're giving them the experience of self-trust so that they can feel whatever is right for them and then roll with that inner healer.
So for those of you that don't know what breath work is.
So breath work is, it's based off of, well, it depends. There's so many different kinds. There's like transcendental rebirthing, Stan Grof's workshops, like holotropic. There's Wim Hof. There's so many different kinds of breath work. But ultimately, it is manipulation of breath to elicit a change in consciousness, a shift from one level of brain activity to another. And so there is not a whole lot of peer-reviewed research on this stuff. But from what I understand, from what I've researched, it's in dramatically increasing the oxygen in your body, which reduces carbon dioxide, which causes the hemoglobin in your blood to hold on to oxygen molecules and not release them properly, which means that blood flow is restricted to certain areas in the body and brain. And so brain is composed of the three layers. The first part, which is like where all your instincts are, like your animal instincts for survival, so hunger, sex, sleep. And then the next part that developed was, so that was the reptilian brain.
Mm.
Then the mammalian brain developed, which is like the ability to feel emotions, like the limbic system, which is why dogs can be happy or sad or afraid. And then as the brain evolved, the layer of the neocortex arrived, which is the part that can consciously think and problem solve and discriminate and like talk about stuff. And so the theory goes that the outermost part of the brain is the youngest, so it's the most sensitive to the chemical change. Mm. And so when you've got all that oxygen coming in and it's unable to be released, that part of the brain gets inhibited, and then you're allowed to drop into your primal state or your emotional state without any interference.
Wow. Okay, so then explain why your fingers start tingling, or some people, the fingers start tingling, and maybe you feel paralyzed in your body.
Yeah,
like,
yeah.
Why is that?
Again, it depends what school you subscribe to, but there are a couple of reasons. If you're looking at it from a purely scientific standpoint, it's because of the oxygen distribution. So you're over-oxygenated, controlled type of ventilation. So basically it's a physical reflection of a change in your chemical state. From a breathwork perspective, it is... any blockages in the body are beginning to dissolve. You're changing the way your energy is moving within your body, and you can feel it. You can feel the sensation change. When your hands cramp up, it's called tetany, which is like in breath work, it's a need to control and a lack of surrender.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah, it's fear manifesting itself in the body. Energy is trying to escape through your hands, and so you cramp up and try and lock it in through the body.
It's amazing.
Yeah, it's crazy.
So for those of you that don't know what Calmably is, it's mindful fun with animals. Working with where I got nicknamed the goat whisperer, because we actually do mindful fun meditation with goats a lot of the time, baby goats and sheep and pigs. But how did that come about? Like, I mean, it's such a far out concept.
Oh, okay. So it was kind of stolen, but not really.
Okay.
So
while
I was in the States, somebody told me they were going to a goat yoga class, and I was like, that's stupid, I'm not going to do that. And then when I came back, I was like, how am I going to make meditation fun and attract droves of people? And I was like, well, maybe I can talk with baby goats.
Yeah.
And then I started researching, and then I found my little farm friends, and just went.
Okay, so talk me through
advice for other yogapreneurs or entrepreneurs.
What did your first event look like? I mean, now you're branded and you've got all of this beautiful stuff.
So actually, what I did was I tested it first.
Mm.
I wasn't going to just go do it at scale without any feedback from people. Like, what if they came and they hated it and I told 10 of their friends that it would be ruined forever? So what I did was I hired the my little farm friends, and then we ran like a first event just with close friends and family, and it was pretty bad. like I rambled incoherently in the beginning, which most people didn't notice except my close friends. They were like, yeah, you were weird. And I was like, well, I was nervous. And then we didn't have enough bins or cleaning equipment, so there's just pee everywhere. We didn't let the animals go on the grass first, which is when they can let go of their bladders and stuff. So they just went like it was like a river as soon as they went to club. It was just like a not nice space. There were stairs. It was great. There were so many things that I had to iron out. I asked everyone for feedback, and then I got all of that, and then I just made it way better for the next one. Yeah.
Wow.
Yes. So make sure you test your ideas before you create some amazing event that you're going to do. You want to test whether people are actually going to buy it, because, like, it's you know, your intention is pure and your work is amazing. There's no doubt. Like, most of us, like, have this incredible wealth of experience and education. Mm. And we think if we just distill it into a package and we, like, you know, and we give it to people, they're going to use it. It's not true.
Mm.
Like, they will only jump in when they identify with a problem that you have highlighted that you definitively say that you can solve. Even if that problem is something like, are you bored?
Yeah, something so simple.
Something so simple. It doesn't have to be like, you know, come and like fix your trauma or whatever, but it's like you've got to give them a problem, and then they've got to see that and be like, oh, that is a problem in my life. Okay, and this person, I can tell from their ad copy, they're actually going to solve it. Like, it's crazy. And then, so the thing is, before you go and create this epic, you know, 12-week course that's going to change someone's life, see if you can sell it first.
Mm.
And then if no one's buying, you know that your sales copy sucks and you need to keep reiterating it. And then once people actually start buying it, or you ask people, like, you know, that you think are your target audience, people that you really want to help, you say, like, you know, can you give me feedback on this? And then they'll say, well, you know, that's kind of boring, you're rambling here, I'd probably just scroll past that. And then you just keep changing it until you give them something that actually would be like, yeah, I'd pay money for that. And then you go and see, even before you're ready, if you can get people to pay for it. And then you create it. It's kind of like this whole principle of, like, don't create all the work if you're not going to be able to help people with all that work.
Burr has been in magazines, on broadcast, on TV, with Calmably Events. How was that the first time it came about, and how did it come about?
The first one was the Gold Coast Bulletin. They contacted me.
Mm-hmm.
That was really exciting. It felt like it was funny because it actually, this is actually quite vulnerable, but I feel like it's important. I felt like I had made it. Like, suddenly, in spite of all the work that I had done until that point, now I was recognized by the media. Therefore, I had, like, achieved something and I was successful. And it was funny because now it happens and it's almost like I'm just like, oh, it's another one. I'm like, okay, cool. yeah, it was really exciting the first time I did it, and it was really fun. And of course, I still enjoy doing it. But I don't put as much stock in it in terms of using it to define my self-worth.
Mm.
Yeah, now it's kind of just like fun. It's not like yes, because the papers or the world has recognized you are important and you are having impact. Like, I think that's something that I've learned quite throughout this, is like you can't measure your success in terms of impact based off of attention.
Mm. Wow, what a great learning.
Mm, yeah, I agree.
Where to now with Calmably? What are the plans or the goals or aspirations?
My focus now is more to build out the back end. Mm. So the whole principle before was Calmably is the gateway. It's like, this is where people get to come in and experience the joy of meditation with baby animals. You know, you don't have to invest anything. It's not like, it's not torture. You're just going to feel good. And then if you want to know more, you know, this is where you go. And so now it's like, okay, got to build out the programs, the content like this that will help people. It's just to open up their, their minds to further investment in their self-awareness, emotional intelligence, and spiritual practice. Yeah.
And what is the lineage of meditation that you teach?
I don't teach from any particular lineage. If I had to identify, it would be Buddhist, but I don't.
So the kind of people that come to Karmably events are normally beginners in meditation. Is that correct? Yes. Yeah. So for people that are trying to get into meditation, are there any books that you would recommend?
Yes.
Yeah.
The Untethered Soul.
Okay. I'll put that in the show notes.
It is such a good book for beginners. It's really relatable. I don't think there's any spiritual language or religious attributions. I think it's all just relating meditation practices to your everyday experience. The other book would probably be Susie's Unplug. Again, it's like she calls it for modern soul seekers.
Okay.
Yeah, it's really good. Oh, and I have a book coming out. Yes, but I don't know when. So at some point, I would recommend that.
What is it going to be called?
Oh, it's a working title, but it's going to be called How to Let Go of the Perfect Pussy, Why Perfectionism Kills Your Courage. It works on two aspects. One, on the perfectionist. So for me, my whole journey was, I need to go and like be happy all the time. I'm so sad. I did all that stuff. And then I was like, no one has the answers. No one is happy all the time. No one knows how to make everyone else happy all the time. And so I just went harder. I just went full perfectionist. And that came from fear. It's like fear of negative experiences, of painful relationships, of emotions that don't feel very good. And you can't live like that. You can't live in fear. That's where the perfectionism comes from. I don't want to feel rejected. I don't want to be hurt. I don't want people to not like me. And so I call that perfectionist the pussy. It is my inner pussy. She's so scared. So, so scared. The whole thing is how to let go of perfectionism, how to let go of that fear. Holding on to it is just going to sabotage your experience and create everything that you're afraid of. The second thing is that the pussy is so taboo. It's like this incredibly vulnerable, beautiful thing that men and women worship everywhere. But then by the same token, it is also this source of shame as well. It's like hidden. It has to be hidden for some reason. It's also a point of shame for women because everyone's is so different. And then you see porn and there's like these neat little pussies and women think that they have to be that way, or men think that's how it is. And then it leads to more shame and repression in society. And so the whole, and then you've got women who actually get surgery to correct that, to correct their natural state. And so the whole thing is how to let go of the perfect pussy.
Wow.
Let go of perfectionism and just experience.
What led you in this direction of creating your book that you're going to publish? How did you get onto that trajectory?
I've got these amazing people working for me. Like, they said they want to help me become an influencer. Yeah, and I was really scared at first. That freaked me out because I was like, but I don't, it's so intense to just stand in front of a class of 40 people, let alone be in that much in the public eye. And also, I had this strange misconception about what an influencer was. I thought that meant that I was just going to, you know, try and look really hot and be an attention seeker. And I was like, I don't want to do that. And then my content creator was like, no, no, no. He's influencer. Like, as somebody who was a trusted advisor who can give advice at scale.
I like that one.
I know. And I was like, oh, I'm like, awesome. Yes, let's do that. And so he's like, great. So you're going to write a book. You're going to build a program. You're going to be on podcasts. And I'm like, okay.
What's been the hardest part of the entrepreneurial journey for you?
I think the aloneness. Actually,
is that because you're putting so much energy into the business that you don't have time to socialize and XYZ, or what do you mean by the aloneness?
The aloneness. Okay, so the aloneness. I mean, because it's your baby, it's your business. You're the only one that knows what is best for everybody. like for your customers, for yourself, for your staff. And it's like you can't defer that to anybody. You just have to own your own decision and know that you're going to fuck up and make lots of mistakes. You're going to like offend customers. You're going to make the wrong decisions and make events go, you know, pear-shaped. You're going to make staff members uncomfortable or give them something they don't like. And you just have to accept that that's all on you. And that's going to happen, like, definitely. And, of course, you know, on the flip side, like, everything that you do as well is because of you. And so it feels amazing when you see people, like, you know, having those healing experiences or your staff members are really happy or the events are going really well. But it is the whole thing of, like, it's always your fault.
How do you, as a healer and a holder of space, protect yourself so that you don't take on people's negative energy, because that can be quite toxic and damaging, can it not?
Yes, absolutely. And this is something that I'm still learning. I've only recently started employing it. But the first thing is mindset, actually. So when I say mindset, I talk about intention. If you go into something thinking that you need to protect yourself, you're already preparing your mind for an enemy, which makes the enemy real, which harms you in and of itself.
Mm.
Does that make sense?
Yeah.
So it's like if there's a negative entity in the room and you're like, I need to do this. You've engaged the part of your mind that is deeply, deeply afraid. And so any, you know, the law of attraction works. Anything that you fear is what will manifest. So you create fear, and then whatever you fear will then come and push against you, an exact opposite and equal force. So the first thing is to hold a space of love, unconditional love. So even if that person is really negative or toxic, you just hold love. And you hold love not as in like, oh, pity love, like that poor soul, they're suffering. It's not like that. It's love like loving the suffering that they're in. Like, oh, they're suffering. Oh, so good. Like, you know, this is the way they express happiness. And whatever they're going through right now is exactly where they need to go to get more happiness. Examples like, sometimes you speak to people who aren't self-aware and you're like, oh, they're just like ruining their relationships. They don't even know. And you feel bad because you're like looking at them and they're sad. But the reality is, if they're doing that, then they're doing whatever makes them the most happy at that moment. And so your sadness is actually just a projection of your own life, and you're creating sadness within you, which has nothing to do with their situation. And so you may as well not feel sad for them and just love where they are, knowing that eventually it's going to change because all things do. So that's what you've got to go into the space with when you try and heal someone, is I'm just loving where you're at. And then on top, when you do that as well, anyone who is in that toxic, agitated state will feel your intention, and then it will raise their frequency as well. So that's the first thing. The second thing is to create a bubble around yourself of like your own self-love. And this is like, you know, the respect that you have for your own boundaries. This has like got nothing to do again with anybody else. It's just I love myself, I respect myself, I have boundaries because that's how I honor my self-love. And then usually what I'll do is create another big bubble outside of that, which is just to hold space, just love.
Yeah.
And then after every event, I try and sage as well to clear the energy. Also, right. I'll do some oils as well.
What's your favorite oil to clear, to use?
To clear tea tree.
Something that I like to ask everyone that comes onto the podcast is if they have a favorite quote that may be moving or helpful to the listeners. What is yours?
Okay, so it's a question. It's by Tom Bilyeu. He says, "What would you do and love even when you're failing?"
What would you do and love even when you're failing? You've shared so much today. It's just been amazing. Thank you so much. If you'd like to find out any more information about Burr and her events, go to comably.com.au. I'll put all the links as well as the recommendations to the books in the show notes. If this podcast helped you in any way and you would recommend it to others, please give us a review, as this helps us to be found. Join us on Cosmic Moments Facebook page to ask any questions or share any requests for upcoming interviews.
Hi there, my name's Jessica Kate.
And I'm Ellen Rose.
And we're the hosts of Murder in the Land of Oz,
a new Australian true crime podcast.
Yes, we're starting off in Brisbane, our hometown, because
relatable.
We're going to be coming to you every second Monday.
So give us a listen, give us a like.
And a subscribe.
Come and join us on our journey where we explore the depths of true crime Australia. Oh yeah.
Hold up. What was that? Boring. No flavor. That was as bad as those leftovers you ate all week. Keke Palmer here. And it's time to say hello to something fresh and guilt-free. HelloFresh. Jazz up dinner with pecan-crusted chicken or garlic butter shrimp scampi. Now that's music to my mouth. HelloFresh. Let's get this dinner party started. Discover all the delicious possibilities at HelloFresh.com.